History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media. MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk. For many politically engaged Americans of a certain age, the mellifluous sounds of Bach's Brandenburg Concerto No. 2 meant one thing: another episode of Firing Line, in which conservative maestro William F. Buckley Jr. would grill some hapless liberal about the pressing issues of the day. Even if, like myself, he didn't agree with Buckley on most things, it invariably made for stimulating debates, and for me at least, sharpened my thinking about world affairs. But this episode I'm going to show here with former CIA spy and Watergate burglar Howard Hunt is in a somewhat different category. The interview was in the spring of 1974 and smack in the middle of Richard Nixon's cover-up of Watergate, in which Hunt's role was central. Buckley, if you watch this on YouTube, asks Hunt quite a bit about his demands to the White House for hush money to keep silent about what he knew, suggesting, with Hunt in full agreement, that such payments should be expected for conducting clandestine missions on behalf of the U.S. government. And at one point, Buckley says this to explain his unusually close relationship with his invited guest.
I'm constrained to say, full disclosure-wise, that I have known Mr. Hunt for 23 years, and I'm the godfather of three of his children and executor of his wife's estate. I add, however, that this program, like all other firing line programs, is entirely unrehearsed.
But it turns out that wasn't full disclosure at all. What Buckley left out is that he himself had worked for Howard Hunt as an undercover CIA operative in Mexico City in the early 1950s, doling out envelopes stuffed with cash to student activists and rewriting an anti-communist memoir that the agency then secretly distributed throughout Latin America. And then years later, Hunt had drawn Buckley into the Watergate cover-up, telling him shocking revelations that at the time nobody else knew: how John Mitchell, Nixon's attorney general, had approved the Watergate break-in, and how before that, Hunt and his co-conspirator G. Gordon Liddy had conducted another blatantly illegal break-in at the offices of a Los Angeles psychiatrist treating Pentagon Papers leaker Daniel Ellsberg. This was crucial information unknown at the time to the FBI and Senate investigators when Hunt divulged it to Buckley in December 1972. And yet Buckley, one of the most widely read newspaper columnists in the country, kept silent about it for months while publicly defending Nixon and Hunt, making him arguably an accessory after the fact to the cover-up of what remains the biggest political scandal in American history. That's the harsh judgment of Sam Tannenhaus, a former editor of the New York Times Book Review, who has just written a new book, Buckley: The Life and the Revolution That Changed America. It's a giant biography, at times sympathetic, but unflinching, and weighing in at over 1,000 pages. It explores Buckley's life as a journalist, author, magazine editor, TV debater, and de facto leader of a conservative movement that changed the direction of the country. But this is Spy Talk, so we're going to focus on what I found some of Tannenhaus' most fascinating revelations: what Buckley actually did during his early stint as a CIA operative, his deep ties to the agency while running his magazine, National Review, and his fateful relationship with the wayward spy in the middle of a scandal that toppled the president. Like Tannenhaus' book, it's an illuminating discussion, and I hope you'll listen. Sam Tannenhaus, welcome to Spy Talk.
Can't wait. This sounds like it's going to be fun.
First of all, congratulations on the book. I know a lot of people have been waiting many, many years for your biography of William F. Buckley. And you finally delivered at 1,000 pages, but it is an engrossing read. There is so much packed into his life. But this is a podcast called Spy Talk. We cater to a national security audience, and I want to focus on what I think is one of the lesser known chapters, perhaps the least known chapter of William Buckley's extraordinary life. And that was his time as a CIA officer in Mexico City. So tell us a bit about how that came about and what William F. Buckley did for the CIA.
So it starts in June of 1950, Korean War. Buckley was then 25 years old. He's a veteran. He served in the armed forces in World War II. He was in the infantry, though never went overseas. And the last thing he wants to do, he's just graduated from Yale. He's got an idea. He's going to write a book about Yale. That's what he wants to do. And we know that book. It's called God and Man at Yale, essentially created the modern conservative movement.
Yeah.
But he's figuring out what to do. And the way he's going to write that book, by the way, Mike, is he's got a teaching gig at Yale for 1 year teaching Spanish. He grew up fluent in Spanish because of this unusual cosmopolitan family he had. And he does not want to put a uniform on and fight in Korea. He's a combat guy, but not that kind of combat. And he has a quite brilliant, unusual eccentric. He's one of the great eccentrics in the story. Professor named Wilmore Kendall. Kendall was himself an intelligence officer. He'd been in the OSS, and all your listeners know what that is, World War II, and on the ground floor of CIA. And he says to Bill Buckley, there's something more interesting you can do. Yeah, this is the shooting war and communism we're all waiting for in Korea. He said, but you don't have to do it that way. You can go work in intelligence. There's this other thing happening. CIA has just started, as you know, started a few years before. It's 1950. It's newly into it. They're setting up all the programs. There's that wonderful book Evan Thomas wrote about all the Yale guys who went to CIA.
Yes.
Bill Buckley was in that class. So a classmate of his, Tom Ginsberg, a famous publisher, says to me, I have in the book, says, well, the Yale faculty, the crew coach and others, were lining up to pick off Yale men of the graduation line. Says they got about half the class, as it turned out, went into CIA. So Kendall says, Wilmore Kendall is now doing intelligence work again for the government. And he was kind of a black sheep because he questioned the whole approach to intel gathering, which we can talk about if there's time, because it became very important. He's got a whole other view on how intelligence should be done. Basically, what it comes down to is don't try to figure out what their next move is the way they were unable to do in Korea, right? George Kennan and company know there's a break coming. They're picking up, right, the data. They're getting the litter. They know there's something out there, but they don't know where it's coming from. Kendall wrote a brilliant, prescient essay on intelligence, and he says, we're doing the wrong thing. Don't try to guess where they're going to hit you next. Try to figure out how they think. Mm-hmm. And that was what Paul Wolfowitz and company later came up with when we were all writing about Iraq all those years later. And I did that interview with Wolfowitz. He talked about intelligence. And that had come out of this idea that they don't think like us. You have to learn how to think like them. Disinformation, psy war, psychological warfare, all this stuff is essential to the movement. And I'm glad we're talking about it here because nobody else ever asked about it. So he says to Bill Buckley, come with me to Washington. Kendall had been going to Bethesda because he's persona non grata at CIA. Wilmore, as everybody called him, was doing work for U.S. Army intelligence. And it later emerged was actually sent to do disinformation in North Korea. They slipped him over the border.
Huh.
So he says to Buckley, come on down. Come with me to Washington. Let's see what we can do about the CIA. So they go, getting you in. So they go off to a Georgetown apartment, a very elegant Georgetown apartment. That's where another one of these Buckley mentors are. pause to tell listeners, if they're not aware, WFB, William F. Buckley's mentors when he was young, were all ex-communists. Whitaker Chambers was one, James Burnham, Wilmore Kendall, Willy Schlamm, these names that have been forgotten.
And James Burnham is the one we're talking about. It's his Georgetown apartment Kendall brings Buckley. Yeah. And I should add one little delicious addition to that. Who else is there?
A guy named E. Howard Hunt was there.
Yes.
And Kendall takes Buckley in and he introduces him to Burnham. And Burnham's a super cool guy, cool in the sense of being a restrained, very WASPy sort of guy. And he meets Buckley. All these refugees are there, right? All these refugees from Central and Eastern Europe are gathering in Burnham's apartment, because Burnham is one of the prophets of the Cold War with his amazing book he wrote called The Managerial Revolution, which George Orwell stole. He stole all the ideas in it and then denounced in the essays he wrote. Well, at any rate, Burnham's there. And then and Kendall introduces him. Buckley goes home, writes his book in the next several months, and he gets a call. Yeah, you're in, and we're going to send you to Mexico City. Because the guy who chose him for that job was another new recruit who'd been in OSS before, wartime OSS, a guy named E. Howard Hunt. They need a guy who's fluent in Spanish. And Buckley grew up speaking Spanish. So Howard Hunt and William Buckley become the CIA office in Mexico City.
You know, here's what's really just leapt out at me in reading all this. This is at the time when Buckley goes down to Mexico City, that God and Man at Yale is being published.
Yeah.
It's getting all this publicity. Buckley is now an instant celebrity. There's all this press coverage and not a word about the fact that he's secretly on the payroll of the CIA at the time.
No, in fact, all the descriptions, like there's a famous profile written of him at this time by Dwight McDonald, who's one of the great journalists of the time. Yeah. Says, well, Buckley's involved in an import-export business in Mexico City. And Bill was very proud of it. And I call him Bill because I know him so well. He always said, well, I was in deep cover. He said, he was in deep cover. And one of the things you want to know is, what did Buckley do he was only there for 8 months. So what did he and Howard Hunt do? People always want to know that. Well, most of the time they went off to a restaurant called the Normandy and had very liquid lunches. And Howard Hunt had a lot of stories to tell about his exploits in World War II. He'd been all over the place. He'd written novels. Buckley's fascinated by him. Howard Hunt was 7 or 8 years older than Buckley. So Buckley's young, and Hunt is still young. He's in his early 30s. But he gave him some assignments. What Hunt was doing was just planning all the surveillance equipment in all the different embassies. Mexico City was the biggest embassy in the hemisphere for the U.S. Right. And so Howard Hunt is you know, gathering up his assets and he's officially working for the embassy. So when I was writing this book, I had to see the embassy because Buckley's father had actually been a refugee in that embassy when he'd been kicked out of Mexico at the time of the Mexican Revolution, you know, 30 years before. So then, so I wanted to see it. It's across the street from this great restaurant. It used to be a favorite restaurant of Gabriel Garcia Marquez in his day. They're working in the embassy. Buckley is living in Coyoacan. He's living across the street from Diego Rivera, the great painter. But what's he supposed to do? Howard doesn't have an assignment for him. So first, he had a small assignment. He was supposed to meet with students at the National University and persuade them to, through the hearts and minds approach, to be part of the non-communist left. Well, to Buckley, there is no non-communist left. Right. If you're on the left, you're a bad guy. But Buckley wants to be the good soldier. He would meet with these students. He'd give them money. He'd give them envelopes with cash. And I said, well, how much was it? He said, I never looked. He said, I'm guessing it was about $400 in each envelope, which is not nothing in 1950 for a young student in Mexico City. Right. I mean, that's
basically the CIA was trying to pay off student activists not to be communists.
Yeah, exactly. And then they found a project for him. They found, which was, they had a book. This is when Buckley met his first true ex-communist operative, a guy named Eudoxio Ravines, who had been like very high ranking in the in the Peruvian and Chilean Communist Party, and he'd written a book called The Great Scam. So La Gran Estafa, I think the name is, that's about the Communist Party in Latin America in the 1930s, the peak of all this stuff. Buckley's job was to translate it because Buckley's Spanish was really good. So he and Ravines would meet several hours a day and translate this book into English and also put in the doctrine, the ideology. I love how they would always call it doctrine back then.
So is it your understanding that, what's his name, Ravines?
Ravines.
The fellow's name, that he actually came to Mexico City and met with Buckley, giving him the Spanish language edition of the book, and Buckley's translating it into English?
They were sitting over the table doing it. Yeah. Yo, right. That's right. And then
so what did the CIA do with the book after Buckley?
Then they distribute it. And what's interesting about it, Mike, is because it gets picked up at a later event that happened that Buckley knew everything about. So the idea is you're going to circulate it underground. You're going to give it's a memoir about the defection, the evils of communism by an ex-communist, like my previous subject, Whitaker Chambers, wrote. So they want to circulate this through Spanish, and Buckley's helping him do it, putting together, spent some months on the book. And Buckley told me this. I couldn't verify it, so I had to leave it out of the book. But I'm going to tell you and their listeners that the book was received very skeptically because Ravines claimed to have met Mao in 1935, in Russia, I think. And Bill said to me, Bill Buckley said, reviewers tracked it down and it didn't compute. There was no evidence that he'd met Mao. And Buckley said, what do we do about this? He said, Ravines told him, if I said I met Mao, I met Mao. I didn't confuse him with anybody else. And then Buckley, to his credit, this is what makes him a little different from some other people circulating in our own moment, is he said that he tracked it down with a respected scholar who told him there was no way Ravines had met Mao.
Is it in the book?
It is in the book.
It isn't. So he left it in the book.
He left it.
And, you know, one thing that puzzled me a little bit, Buckley's translating it into English, but for the CIA, I would think they would want it distributed in Spanish, right?
Yeah, you just reminded me, I got it backward because it had, he was translating it back into Spanish for circulation. That's what it was. It had come out and it had gotten some attention. They needed the new CIA approved edition to circulate in Latin America. That's what Buckley was there for.
Right.
Buckley's Spanish was good enough.
Buckley does edit the manuscript to conform with what the CIA wants the book to say.
That's right. And that's the beginning of the kind of relationship Buckley had with CIA, because what I found is through the years, and we know this, you know far more about this than I do, a lot of journalists, including really respected ones, became CIA assets one way or another, all through the Cold War. Time magazine would publish a big story on Chile, and that information is coming out of the CIA bureau.
No, I want to get to Chile in a moment, but you know, he doesn't last that long at the CIA. Oh, one little detail that I love in the book is you mentioned before Dwight MacDonald's reference to Buckley being in the import export trade. That was his cover. He's posing as a businessman with an alias.
Yes.
Jeffrey T. Bolgiano.
Bolgiano. And they gave it to him. And it's so funny because Buckley, you know, not to stereotype, Buckley does not look like a Bolgiano. But yeah, that was it. And of course, in Latin America, names and backgrounds get very complicated because, you know, it's a culture like ours with some mixes. Right. The thing to remember is Buckley's Spanish at his peak was really good. He was not just a guy who learned it. He grew up speaking Spanish with his Mexican maids, and his father was totally fluent in Spanish.
Right.
So it made sense to send him there. And you can also see an FBI interview with Buckley where he talked about his father's history in Mexico. There's some interesting stuff that you know you can.
What was the FBI interview?
Well, the FBI got very interested in Buckley because of this event he'd staged at Yale, and they wanted to recruit him. Buckley was being he met Hoover when he was very young, and they knew who he was. And in that smaller world, I guess it still happens today, but in that smaller world, you know, they could have your eye on you pretty early. And Buckley was a guy who'd emerged as, you know, this brilliant, young, militant anti-communist. We're not just talking about a guy who says, you know, the system doesn't work. And this is a guy who, you know, who's ready to go to war with it. So that's what he did. And then at the same time, his book explodes back in the U.S. And God, Man, Yale, he knows he'll get some attention for it because it's timed with Yale's 250th anniversary. The Buckley family had money and gave it to the publisher to help promote it. But it became really a sensation. And Buckley found the CIA were tedious. You know, just the way La Carre says, well, one of the British reviewers of my book says, the pages on Buckley in Mexico that remind you of John Le Carre. They're sitting around drinking all the time with nothing to do. Then after he went back, Howard Hunt got pulled into the big.
Right. Yeah. With the coup in Guatemala.
And he had a pretty big role in that, doing the propaganda.
Central role.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Buckley's only there for 8 months. He works for the CIA. What is the significance of Buckley's experience with the CIA, and how did it? My sense is, you present it as a formative one that, like, actually informed much of his later career in journalism and political activism. In your mind, what's the significance of Buckley's time with the CIA?
Buckley was a club man. He was a born club man. And the genius, the originality of his attack on Yale. People have been attacking Ivy League universities forever. Donald Trump, you know, didn't invent it. Buckley right. didn't invent it. But the attack that comes from the last man tapped for bones, which is the single highest accolade. Right, everybody's gathered in the courtyard, and the members are tapping next year's members for the secret society. It's done publicly, so suspense builds. Who's going to be the last guy tapped? And it's Bill Buckley. So he loved all the ritual and secrecy. You know that Robert De Niro film, The Good Shepherd, that captures some of that quality of Buckley's time at Yale. So you're inside the secret club, and that's how Buckley began to view his class of conservatives, that they are there. He and a few people who are like-minded, Kendall, Burnham, and some others, they're going to be the Machiavellians who help the movement work. And one way you do that is you guard secrets and you protect people. You look out after your assets. And he never lost that view. The other thing, Mike, I'm sure some of the mature members of your audience know it. He wrote some quite good spy thrillers. One after another was a bestseller. And he wrote the first novel called Saving the Queen, published in 1976, to describe his own training. And he got permission to do it when nobody else was allowed to, because Buckley was so trusted by CIA that if, you know, he didn't give, essential state secrets away, he didn't know them. But he could tell you the training he got in Washington. He describes it in that first novel. You know,
and what influence did the CIA background have on, you know, his days as editor of National Review, on as a newspaper columnist, as
information? He and Burnham were tied, remained close. And Kendall, while he was still at the magazine, he was kind of a loose cannon sort of thing. They had contacts all the way through. So an example, good example is like with Castro. Once Castro became a problem in 1959, 1960, they're getting information on him from CIA contacts. And you can look at early writing Buckley did, was really surprised. 2 years right before the Cuban Missile Crisis, he says, they're going to bring missiles over there. Russians are going to plant them over there. What are we going to do about it? You know, so he's following. And other people have these suspicions. He's getting direct information from people like Howard Hunt, who's still in CIA, and another good friend of his named Dino Pianzio, who had been the valedictorian of his class, Bill's class at Yale, and with Buckley wasn't Skull and Bones. So it really is like these movies you watch. And Pianzio became the deputy bureau chief, I think, for the diplomatic office in Chile, Santiago. And so when Buckley was sent there, Pianzio was the guy who was taking him around. But in addition to this, earlier, what Buckley was doing was giving the view on communism, on the global chess game, Buckley and Burnham, that came from CIA. Here's the move they're going to make. You know, maybe it's okay to try to neutralize Germany. I mean, they would say these things that for conservatives were real heresy, because in the strategic chess game, it might be a way to get out in front of the Soviets and figure out where the losses and gains might come. So a lot of this came through in National Review. And another of the eminences there, Frank Meyer, who was one of the big ideologues at National Review, was convinced the whole magazine was a CIA front.
Yes, I saw that. That was amazing.
And he said that to Gary Wills.
Senior editor who thinks Buckley's running the magazine for the CIA.
And he's saying it to like junior colleagues, because Meyer and Burnham were real adversaries. They'd met at Princeton, and Burnham was very much the classic Cold Warrior, kind of the John Foster Dulles style Cold Warrior, where Frank Meyer is really the wild-eyed ex-communist, you know, who's ready to have nuclear war tomorrow. And Meyer would say, the stuff Burnham's saying, he's getting that from CIA officers. Because, yeah, as you know, CIA in those years, they were the anti-communist liberals, the hearts and minds guy. George Kennan, you know. And Kennan and Burnham had this big ideological dispute that played out in the Washington press and all this. And Meyer says, he said, I think they're running this as a front. They're running as a front for CIA. He told that to his young protege, Gary Wills, who was their brightest young talent at the magazine, and was writing, you know, mainly literary back of the book pieces for them. But Meyer confided in him, and he said, I think he's running it as a CIA front. And he would go to the bookshelf, Meyer would, and pull down the famous essay Orwell wrote on Burnham, Second Thoughts and James Burnham. Christopher Hitchens told me that he thought that was the greatest essay that George Orwell ever wrote, was his attack on James Burnham, in which he said, this guy's not about democracy versus communism. This guy's not about the virtues of capitalism versus communism. This guy's about power. It's all about power. Who's going to win? Who's going to be on top? Who do you align yourself with? And Meyer, who's the kind of pure-hearted ideologue, is shocked by that. And he thinks Buckley's getting pulled into it by Burnham. Very interesting. This is like, remember, early 1950s. Most people don't even know what the CIA is at this point, right? There's no oversight, no congressional oversight. It doesn't be, we remember when it blew up and became a big deal. But at this point, it's really secret. So Buckley could talk to an informed journalist and say he's doing import-export in Mexico City, and no one's going to ask him what he means by that. No one's going to press below the surface.
Yeah.
Let's take a quick break here. And when we come back, we're going to talk to Sam Tenenhaus about that relationship that Buckley had with Howard Hunt and how it drew him very much into the middle of Watergate. And now we're back with Sam Tenenhaus, author of the new book, Buckley, The Life and the Revolution That Changed America. Sam, we've been talking about Buckley's role in the CIA in Mexico City and how it influenced the course of his career. But the Mexico City days really come back to Buckley with a vengeance in 1972. With the Watergate break-in, because one of the orchestrators of Watergate was the aforementioned E. Howard Hunt, Buckley's boss at the CIA, and somebody with whom he was very, very close.
Bill and Pat Buckley were the godparents to Howard Hunt's three of his four children. And that happened in Mexico City. They were all Catholics. They kind of were Catholics together. I saw the document that Buckley and his wife signed agreeing to be godparent, which meant that he would look out for the children in the event anything happened to either parent or both. So Watergate happens in June 1972. Buckley's being Buckley, which means he's on a cruise somewhere in the Aegean. He's seen his friend David Niven at Cap d'Antibes. He's leading the Buckley life. And so, you know, right before the 1972 election campaign, Nixon sailing along, Buckley had been doing some kind of CIA-related work there too. During the time of the revolution, the election in Chile, Buckley had gone over written columns that would essentially help pave the way for the CIA-managed coup in Chile. So that's 1971. Then in 1972, he opens up the newspaper and sees what everybody else does. There's been a break-in, the arrest of the Watergate. Buckley kind of follows it. Then the stories start to come that one of the managers of the operation is E. Howard Hunt, who was working with, they called the Cubans, who were exiles from Castro's Cuba living in Miami. And Buckley was aware that Hunt had all these connections. Hunt had been a casualty of the Bay of Pigs. He'd gotten out of the operation right before it began, but he was driven out. He was driven out by Kennedy men. And so he was kind of living on the cheap now. And Buckley had been helping him out for years, finding money for him, finding jobs, apartments. Buckley did this countless numbers of people. And he says to Howard Hunt, he says to him, well, listen, we've got National Review. We know whatever you did, you've been arrested in this break-in. We know you did it for virtuous, patriotic reasons. So write an article for our magazine explaining what you did. And Howard Hunt suddenly goes silent. He doesn't hear from him.
Right.
Then Hunt is indicted in Washington with the other felons, and he is about to be convicted. And then in December of 1972, a plane overshoots the runway at Midway Airport in Chicago, bursts into flames on a suburban street, and the 40 dead passengers include Howard Hunt's widow, Dorothy, who's got $10,000 in cash. And we have to remind listeners that $10,000 in cash, again, was real money back then. So Howard Hunt gets a phone call. Yeah, what was going on? So we're going to start a business deal, though. No, it was Watergate hush money he was carrying. And then Buckley hears from him. So we want to talk about that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Buckley's Buckley's got two gorgeous homes. He's his beautiful estate, Waterside Estate in Stamford, Connecticut, and he has this magnificent apartment in Manhattan. And then out comes, first he gets a phone call. Bill, you know, very nervous, Howard, I have to come see you. Buckley invites him over to the maisonette, as they called it, the ground floor apartment in his Park
Avenue.
This
is the New York apartment.
New York apartment. Right. But Brooke Astor lives in the top floors, and Bill and Pat Buckley live in the bottom. This is high society in New York.
Yep.
Howard Hunt comes in, and he says, now I'm going to tell you everything. And what does everything mean? It doesn't start with Watergate. Watergate is the last piece of a puzzle that began when Hunt and the Cubans broke into the psychiatrist's office of Daniel Ellsberg, who had released the Pentagon Papers at an earlier date, as you know from the book. Buckley had actually tried to discredit through a disinformation campaign in National Review. He and his allies invented such like tonally perfect parodies, inventions of fake Pentagon Papers documents to muddy up the investigation, the uncovering of it, that journalists were fooled by it. The Post and the Times are running stories about the new documents National Review found. At the same moment he's doing that, which is the summer of 1971, Howard Hunt is in Washington organizing their disinformation campaign.
And doctoring cables, State Department cables, to show that John F. Kennedy ordered the assassination of Diem in South Vietnam.
That's right. And why were they doing that? Because Nixon feared, above all, as an opponent, Edward Kennedy.
Right.
So he wanted to get at the, you know, all these kind of triple bank shots.
So Hunt comes to Buckley and spills his guts, tells him about the break-in at the psychiatrist's office, tells him John Mitchell had approved the Watergate operation, tells him about the cables that he doctors. What does Buckley do with this information?
And this is where Bill Buckley goes into full spy mode. The first thing he does is protect. He's going to protect Howard Hunt. What's interesting about Buckley, Mike, what makes him a different kind of guy is he's not doing it to protect Nixon. He didn't like Nixon. Nobody in Buckley's team was pro-Nixon. Nixon had done one thing they liked, which was to prosecute Alger Hiss in that spy case that involved, you know, from the late 1940s involving Whitaker Chambers. Otherwise, he's too much the centrist for them. He's not an ideological right winger. But Howard Hunt is now in trouble. Not only because Howard tells Buckley all this stuff. Buckley doesn't know what to do. He just wants to protect his friend Howard Hunt. So in his column, and Nixon, you know, we found this in the White House tapes. Nixon is telling Chuck Colson, who was Hunt's boss, we'll get Buckley to write columns. You know, let's get Buckley on the case to protect these guys. And Buckley didn't need to be told that. So he was really offended later when the implication was that he'd been told by Nixon to protect Hunt, because no, he's doing it out of his own loyalty to Hunt. But what Buckley does is, so he tries to downplay Watergate all the time. Say it's a caper. Remember, that was the word they all used for Watergate for a real long time. Mm-hmm. But Buckley is a man of honor, and he's a totally devout Catholic. So what I discovered when I looked closely at his writing was he was dropping hints in his column that nobody would pick up on, but that he could later cite was evidence. He said, well, I don't think we're going to see anything terrible come of this Watergate investigation. It's all going to go away unless, say, they ordered the assassination of the columnist Jack Anderson. And you're thinking, what? What are you talking about?
Which was talked about inside the Nixon White House.
That's right. And Hunt.
By the way, Buckley had Hunt on firing line.
He did.
In the middle of all this.
And
he says, in full disclosure, we have been friends for 23 years. Doesn't say how they had become friends and the fact that they had worked together at the CIA. That's left out of the full disclosure. But the whole purpose was to portray Hunt's demands not as blackmail, as John Dean had described them to Nixon, but as, you know, the expected payments for somebody who conducts a clandestine mission for the government.
And the word Buckley would use all the time, philanthropy. We have to protect these men who honorably were doing what their government asked them to do. But there's a very interesting moment in that interview, the firing line interview. Hunt's now been indicted. He's enjoined. He's been convicted. He's enjoined from speaking about the case. He can't do that, but he can go up and talk about Cuba. Their topic is supposed to be Cuba. So there's a third man present, Cuban exile. And Buckley says, before we get to that, just let me ask you one thing. Is it fair to say the Watergate break-in was conducted in the spirit of a CIA operation? And Hunt says, yes. And that's it. And one guy picks up on it, a great journalist from even before our era, though we knew him, a guy named Tad Schultz, who wrote for the New York Times. He'd been the journalist who had broken the Bay of Pigs case before it happened. Yeah. And Buckley cooperated with Schultz in a biography of Hunt, which is actually a pretty good little book on Hunt the spy.
Yeah.
And And Schultz notes this. He thinks it's a key moment that the two of them, Buckley and Hunt, if anybody is listening to them, they're telling you this is something that may have CIA fingerprints on it, because Hunt had supposedly retired from the agency when he went to work for Nixon. But in fact, this ties, we know this, they never go away. And Hunt had been using his CIA contacts to conduct all these undercover operations.
And it's worth remembering that the Republicans on the Senate Watergate Committee, led by Howard Baker and his chief investigator, Fred Thompson, were very much focused on investigating the CIA's role in Watergate. It wasn't just Hunt. James McCord actually got the equipment that was used for the Watergate surveillance from the CIA.
There's another guy, Sturgis. Frank Sturgis, he's the one who blew Buckley's cover in an interview with Jack Anderson, because Sturgis showed him a letter in which he'd said, well, Howard Hunt is a good friend of Bill Buckley, William Buckley, the columnist. And apparently Buckley told Hunt, when you go over to the White House to work for them, you know, see what you can do. And the idea is going to be some kind of CIA work. And that's what Anderson, he tells Jack Anderson, gets this information. Buckley knows from Howard Hunt that there was talk of assassinating Anderson. Jack Anderson calls Buckley up, says, is it true you're in the CIA? And Buckley says, yes, I was in deep cover. Buckley does not say, be careful, Jack Anderson, they may be coming after you.
Was that the first time he ever publicly admitted that he had worked for the CIA?
First time publicly, yeah. What happened before then was, boy, I can tell you know this stuff really well. Because what you're asking about is a conversation he'd had with his friend Bill Coffin, William Sloan Coffin. This is what this world was like, Mike. William Sloan Coffin, who's the chaplain at Yale University, was a great friend of Buckley's and also
and
in the CIA.
Anti-Vietnam War activist.
super anti-Vietnam, defender of the Black Panthers when they had a trial in New Haven. He'd been in the CIA. So Bill Buckley and Bill Coffin are having a conversation, and Coffin says, it's a famous exchange, became famous. Coffin said, well, you know, one of the Nixon's guys, not in the break-in, but one of the operatives, Jeb Magruder, was my student when I taught at Williams College. And Buckley can't help himself. He says, oh, really? Well, Howard Hunt was my boss in the CIA. And it got picked up by a society columnist, Maxine Cheshire. It got circulated. And it was kind of below the radar. Something that's interesting. One thing the publication of my book has made me realize, has brought home to me, is we really are in a horseshoe moment now where left and right agree about a lot. You know, the middle is it, right? The middle is the enemy. Left and right agree about a lot. Some of the first people to start tracing Buckley's connections to Watergate were these far right conspiracy theorists like Willis Carto, the super racist guy. They had publications that said, one of them was called Buckley, Watergate Godfather, because the film had just come out. He says, well, here are all the people Buckley knows who were involved in Watergate. And the list gets pretty long. And because they were on the far right, nobody listened to them. The one guy, the one big guy journalist who was asking questions from the start was Wills, because Frank Meyer had told him back in the 50s. So Wills starts publishing these things in the New York Review of Books or in his own column. What's going on with Buckley and Hunt? Why is Buckley covering up for this guy? You know, and then that's what caused really.
And you make the point he did cover up. In fact, you say he was an accessory after the fact to the cover up of Watergate, because he knew information nobody else knew, not the Justice Department, not the FBI, not the Senate Watergate Committee, and he kept silent about it.
And so I have a question for you, Mike, listen, for people of my era, you're one of our, you know, great investigative journalists. In this day and age, would a Bill Buckley, the newspaper columnist, the big media guy, get away with not being questioned by anybody? Why did Bob Woodward, when he wrote his big story in the Post about the Jack Anderson assassination plot, why did he not make the phone call to his fellow Yale man, Buckley, and say, do you have anything to say about this? Because I've been looking at your columns and you make references to it. What did you know? Why were they giving him a pass all the time?
My quick answer to that is, 10 years ago, you wouldn't have been able to get away with it as a newspaper columnist if you were concealing such relevant information. But I got to say, at this point in time in American life, I think anybody can get away with anything as we see on the front pages of the paper every day.
So we've come around. We're really back where they were. Because one thing that really struck me, I'm sure you noticed this when I describe it, is that it's not just Bob Woodward. It's Theodore White. It's Tony Lucas, who wrote a really good book called Nightmare about Watergate, based on his reporting. All they ever say is, well, William Buckley, the eminent journalist, is a friend of Howard Hunt's. And nobody says to him, we're looking at the stuff you wrote. You knew everything. Why didn't you? I believe Woodward himself went to the Senate Watergate Committee and told them about the taping he'd learned about. I mean, there were things as a citizen.
I'm not sure that's journalistically appropriate. I would draw the line. You write the story and let the authorities take it from there if they think there's something worth taking. But look, there's a final chapter to this story that is actually a sort of interesting wrinkle, not to be expected. And that is, all this knowledge that Buckley has about Watergate does weigh on him. And as you've shown in so many other aspects of his life, he does shift. And in an important way, he plays kind of covert role in helping to get rid of Richard Nixon.
The unsung Buckley, one of the pleasures of writing a book like this is you just get to dig a little deeper. Bill Buckley's older brother, James Buckley, was actually quite a gifted man himself and became the first ever member of the Conservative Party, which Buckley invented, by the way, in the early 1960s. To be elected to the U.S. Senate because of a three-way race. There was a three-candidate race. And James Buckley squeezed in 1970. So he became senator from New York, junior senator Jacob Javits, who is a senior senator.
Beating the father of the NFL commissioner, by the way.
Yes, he did.
Throw that little
Charlie Goodell, who became a friend of his, too. That was typical of Buckley. Everybody would become their friends. Bob Woodward went sailing with William F. Buckley. I mean, that's how they lived. Well, Buckley was really pragmatic politically, and he never liked Nixon. And when Spiro Agnew, the vice president, went down and kind of lied about his own troubles, Buckley was really disgusted by that. And he saw the criminality was out of control. And he tells his good friends, Ronnie and Nancy Reagan, because Ronald Reagan is governor of California. He's heir apparent. And he's the biggest. Rick Perlstein is very good on this in his book. He was the biggest supporter of Nixon throughout all of Watergate. He went to the mat for him every single time. This is just revenge from Democrats. They can't accept that Nixon got reelected. There's no crime. These are honest, good patriots, meaning Hunt and the rest. But Buckley out at the Bohemian Grove, where else, out in California, talks to some top people in the administration, including his Yale friend and Hillbilly's camp buddy, George H.W. Bush. And they tell him, Nixon's in trouble here. He's really going to go down. So Buckley says to Ronnie and Nancy Reagan, don't stay too long. Cut yourself loose. You're going to have to cut yourself loose. Then he's back home. He's in the UN now. One of Buckley's great moments is when he's the human rights advocate at the UN. It's one of the great things he did in his career. He did it for 6 weeks. And then he's back in New York, pulls Jim Buckley aside, his brother, his older brother, and says, listen, the Republicans are not letting Nixon go. You're sticking with him. Go out there, go before the public and say, as a patriot, Nixon needs to resign. And there were a few other members of their group, their brotherhood, as they would call one another, in that sort of Catholic intellectual circle. In other words, a guy named Frank Shakespeare, amazing, his name is actually Shakespeare, who ran the United States Information Agency. And when Buckley was actually on its board, a whole other story that we don't have time for. And Frank Shakespeare is also telling Jim Buckley, no, you got to let Nixon go. He's going down on this thing. He is, once these tapes come out, right? It was a different age, Mike. We remember it. No, when tapes came out that implicated presidents in wrongdoing, even Nixon, they kind of have to own up to it. You can't pretend it's all an invention. So he says, you go before the
public. Can I just bring it? I was in college at the time, and we used to like reenact the tapes.
Oh, did you?
In my dorm. You know, somebody would play Haldeman, somebody would play Ehrlichman.
Yeah, I
somebody would play Coulson.
We did the same thing. I had a friend in college who would do this thing where he'd all pretend to put his hand over a microphone and say, but it would be wrong. He tells him, you've got to get rid of him. So what happens? James Burnham, who's a great theorist at National Review and one of the first great critics of the imperial presidency, got on the case long before Arthur Schlesinger, writes a statement with Jim Buckley, who is a lawyer, quite brilliant lawyer. They work out the statement where James Buckley is going to go before the country, do it in a big Senate caucus room with all those cameras, and say Nixon should resign. And he did it.
And Bill Buckley reviews that statement paragraph by paragraph, goes over it with Brother Jim.
You got to get it right. And what's interesting is this is the line that jumped out at me when I think of, because one thing, a point I want to make in the book is part of the genius of National Review, founded in 1955, is it's the first really serious publication that questions the excessive power of the presidency. Because a lot of the modern right came out of that. You know, you can make a case that if Franklin Roosevelt had not run for the third term, great journalist, liberal journalist Richard Rovere said this, if Wendell Willkie had gotten elected in 1940, the country might have been spared a lot of grief, because it created this idea that presidents get to do whatever they want. And so Burnham writes the statement for Jim Buckley in which he says, for Nixon to justify his position and properly rule, R-U-L-E, he should resign his office. And I'm thinking, rule? Presidents don't rule. Kings rule. Why are they saying this? And then Buckley, Bill Buckley in his writing said, well, let's admit our presidents are monarchs. Yeah. And you start to see they're weighing all this stuff right then. They know what's going to happen.
You know, in a way, because and I was fascinated in your book, you make the point that inside the White House, they saw this as a Bill Buckley operation.
Pat Buchanan told me that.
Buckley had become Brutus, but in a way, it was a covert op.
You know, right? I hadn't thought of it that way till you said it. Yeah.
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 Well, you know, this was his final.
Right. The final op, right? It's like one of those great films, though.
The final, final op. I think Jeffrey D. Bolgiano would be proud.
That's right. He took the president down, you know, and it's very interesting that they did it. They knew it had to be done. And that, by the way, also in the trajectory of Buckley's own life, because that's a beat before the movement rescues itself, the conservative movement with the ascendancy of Reagan. Buckley then became the great defender of the CIA. At the time of the Frank Church's investigations, those really extraordinary investigations.
So, final word here: what should we make of all this? The CIA role and the Watergate days with Howard Hunt. What's your final takeaway?
Buckley was a man of many facets and sides. He's an enormously complex figure, and part of that complexity grows out of an idea he'd had all his life about the potential dangers of democracy. Democracy is in one place and rule of law is in another, exactly what we're living in today. And that he saw his life as a series of moral choices he was going to make. And I think that's where we are now. I think it's one reason people are interested in his life again is, you know, I don't write conventional biographies. I think of them as really moral dramas. Like, you take a great figure in history, they say, okay, what are the crises that face him? The CIA kind of led Buckley to a place where he becomes part of a secret club within the government. We haven't talked about his great friend, Henry Kissinger. One reason Buckley was doing all this stuff is to protect Kissinger as well. Yeah. But in the end, there's a code. There's a higher code. And that's the gentleman's code, but it's also the constitutional code and the moral code. You have to be able to look your friends in the eye. The difference between WFB, William F. Buckley Jr., and many we see today is they don't have friends who disagree with them, whose respect they need to earn. You know, Buckley had Woodward and Bernstein on firing line.
I noticed that. So I guess, and my last question, just playing off your comments there, Buckley died in 2008.
The age of 82.
Okay. I'm going to ask you a question I once asked his son, Chris. And I'm sure it's a question many people are going to be asking you. What would he have made of Donald Trump?
You know, Donald Trump is mentioned once in a book of, we'll set aside Notes and Index, of close to 900 pages. And the one mention comes when the friend they had in common, Roy Cohn, was being threatened with disbarment at the time, the moment he's dying of AIDS, which he's covering up. And as part of his defense against disbarment, a series of very high-profile, respected public figures testified to his good character. And one of them is the columnist Bill Sapphire. Another was Barbara Walters, the TV personality and interviewer. Another one was the real estate entrepreneur. And another was William Buckley. And Bill Buckley went before the committee, and this disbarment committee, ethics panel of judges, and said, I can't imagine any questionable, dubious activity that Roy Cohn would be involved in. Because Roy Cohn was his friend going back to the days when they were both involved with Senator Joseph McCarthy.
Loyal to his friends to the end. Sam Tenenhouse, I want to thank you for a fascinating discussion. There is so much to this book. Listeners, don't be put off by its 1,000 pages. It's an engrossing read. Anybody interested in the political, cultural, ideological clashes of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, I would say this is a must read for anybody. So thanks for writing it, and thanks for doing the podcast, Sam.
My pleasure, Mike. Really enjoyed it.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
Hi, I'm Mojiela Wodeyal from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.